97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Good morning. Good morning. This is 97.1 FM Talk. This is the Medical Beat, formerly known as the Ion Health Show. So we're here with the Medical Beat, and we've got Dr. Sony Sacrani as co-host. We have Nancy Spargo here as our guest, and we'll talk more about her in just a moment. We have Carl on the board. Hello. Say hi, Carl.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. And, and I almost forgot about me, Dr. Steve Harvey, your
job,
host.
Good job, doctor.
Yeah, what's that?
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you. Yay me. So today we have, as our guest, we have Nancy Spargo, who is CEO. Tell me if I got this right. She is CEO of Sparlin Mental Health.
Good job.
Thank you. Yay. All right. Hey, two in a row there. And that's a large mental health practice, somewhat specializing in trauma and trauma-informed care, I think. But before I venture into stuff I don't know anything about, let me turn this over to Nancy. Can you tell us about, let's start with this. Can you tell us about trauma-informed care? What is it and what's it for? And what's that all about?
I would love to. And thank you for the opportunity to be able to talk about trauma-informed care. I'm just a little passionate about this topic.
Yeah.
So trauma-informed care is an approach to delivering any type of human service. It can be done by anybody, regardless of your degree, regardless of the sector, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's medical, school, anything that is human services. And what it is it's an approach to how you deliver your services that is defined by what SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, defines trauma-informed care by the four core assumptions and five key principles. And so I can tell you what those are if you like, but that's what trauma-informed care is.
Yeah, yeah. So it's all about being sensitive and aware to issues people might have due to trauma?
Well, the four R's, so to speak, to recognize the trauma when it's in action. Uh-huh. How do you understand people's behaviors, their attitudes, their interactions? Is there a trauma influence in that?
Yeah.
To recognize that trauma is pervasive. Mm-hmm. If you start looking at the numbers, there's hardly anybody who doesn't have some form of trauma along the way, if not multiple forms of trauma. To be able to see that there are pathways to recovery is also super important. And that it is a comprehensive approach. It's not just delivering services. It's the way an organization functions. It's the way employees are supported and cared for. It's the entire organization.
Oh,
and the fourth R is to avoid re-traumatization. And so to be very intentional as to where the risks might lie and how to avoid those.
Nancy, I was very impressed by you including the one of the R's, which said that it is pervasive.
That's not my work. That's SAMHSA's work.
And so that is, I think, the most important thing is it is pervasive. And as we recognize trauma and as a community, as a country, as a society, we understand that it is not only in specific populations like those who have gone to war, but it is pervasive in general populations, in daily interactions with people who you may not have understood their life stories. And people who have trauma are walking among us. And how
everywhere.
Do we? Yes. Yeah. And how do we respond to it? That's appreciate that.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess there's a lot of different sources of trauma, but I guess the people usually think of wartime trauma or sexual assault. I guess there's the list doesn't stop there. I guess there's a lot of different types of trauma
that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think people traditionally think about trauma as an individual experience.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
By and large. So whether it's due to war or interpersonal trauma such as sexual assault, sexual abuse, domestic violence, those kinds of things. Even neglect is traumatic for for
absolutely.
A child.
In children, yes.
And so I think that used to be what people would understand as trauma. And to be very honest, trauma still carries, unfortunately, a stigma because people look at the impact of trauma as being somehow reflective of your character, that somehow that makes you damaged or less than in some way. And so there's all this stigma. But in reality, trauma can result from institutionalized racism. Trauma can result from living in poverty, from being homeless.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Any kind of oppression, if you are a part of the LGBT community and you have been oppressed, that you could have had all kinds of traumatic experiences. And so one of the things that I like to point out is the actual definition of trauma. Trauma is an experience where somebody either perceives or really is in imminent danger. So it can be you directly, or it can be somebody that you care about, that you love and care about. And that experience overwhelms your ability to cope.
Function. It affects your daily function.
Right. So SAMHSA talks about the three E's. There's an event. There's an event that you can identify. There's a car crash, for example. And then there's your experience of that event. So how do you react in the here and now after that car crash? And then there are the effects. And the effects are what lasts. So do you have nightmares? Are you afraid to drive? Do you not want to drive with somebody else? Do you avoid that intersection? Et cetera, et cetera.
Right,
so you have three E's, the event, the experience, and the effects. And again, that's from SAMHSA.
We're not in the age of just pulling yourself up, sucking it up, and moving on. We're in the age of actually saying, this happened, this must be serious, and you're affected by it, and what can we do about it?
And it's normal to be affected by this.
Absolutely.
The event itself may not be a normal event, so neglect or sexual abuse, something like that. We don't want to consider that a normal event, but the response to that event is very much normal, and people don't understand that.
And then, as you said, just a large fraction of people out there have suffered from some kind of trauma, and they carry that trauma with them every day.
So every single day.
Every single day. So we have to know about what can we do to make that better and to mitigate that problem. So
To be very honest, trauma impacts upon how people can access services,
how they can
make use of services. It impacts upon how the employees, the providers, deliver their services. So, I mean, there are a lot of,
a lot of layers.
A lot of layers is a good way to say it.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that when we come back right after these messages. We're back.
I still have my doubts.
This is the Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. We got me, Dr. Steve Harvey. We have Dr. Sony Sacrani co-hosting.
Hello.
And we have Nancy Spargo from Sparlin Mental Health, telling us about a very important topic, which is trauma. And I think there's sort of two different topics we've been bouncing back and forth between. So we've been talking about trauma itself and the treatment of trauma, and we've also been talking about trauma-informed care. So just to make sure we got our heads on straight here, can you kind of tell us about what's the difference between the two and what are those two different things?
How do we understand that?
I'm so glad you asked, because this is confusing to a whole lot of people, including some of the professionals. Trauma treatment is the actual intervention to help somebody recover from trauma. So, for example, if you have PTSD, which is the diagnosis that most people are familiar with when it comes to trauma, if you have PTSD, there are treatments for eliminating the symptoms of, or significantly reducing, if not eliminating, the symptoms of PTSD. So, for example, at Sparlin, we use prolonged exposure for treating PTSD because that's the gold standard for PTSD. That's a trauma treatment focused on an individual.
Yeah.
Trauma-informed care is an approach, and it's an approach of the entire organization to how they function, how they deliver their services, how they, how they support their staff, how they write their policies and procedures. It's the how that yeah. counts when it comes to trauma-informed care.
Nancy, yeah. what kind of organizations are you interacting with when you say organizations in delivering care? Are these businesses? Are these mental health organizations? What kind of organizations have you dealt with?
Oh, I've dealt with schools, even sure. in fact, adult learning schools. I've dealt with substance use providers, domestic violence providers, homeless providers, mental health providers, child welfare providers. Again, that just about any sector you can think of would find this helpful in terms of improving their services, improving the effectiveness of their services, and improving their outcomes.
So this is for people who come to them and as well as people who work in the organization.
For sure.
Is that right?
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. And can you give us an example or two of like a organization that like of how trauma-informed care improves care delivery from an organization?
So it's usually at multiple levels.
Yeah.
It's again, most people start with the participants or the clients,
yeah.
the patients, right, that are being served. But to be very honest, so there's something called secondary traumatic stress or vicarious trauma.
Yeah.
And basically, in a very simple, brief nutshell, what secondary traumatic stress is the impact of witnessing other people's experiences, traumatic experiences, on the person who is actually the helper.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that takes its toll, which... Yeah. It's normal that it would take its toll. And to be very honest, that's what makes us good is because we care and because we feel that, right? If we didn't care and we didn't feel that, we would really be insensitive and would not be able to help people.
Yes, yes.
Plain and simple. So that vicarious trauma can really wreak havoc with the workforce. It can cause burnout. People can leave the field if they don't have the adequate supports and they're not intentional about how they're going to manage that. Mm-hmm. Now you have staff turnover. And staff turnover is costly, both in terms of client care, patient care, as well as the expense of hiring and onboarding a new employee.
Oh, yeah. So people in some types of jobs are exposed to a lot of trauma,
even
if it's witnessing other people's horrible things.
So I was working in a school, for example, that is a career school, and the students were sharing their experiences both in the classroom formally as well as outside the classroom informally. And the instructors did not have the supports they needed to be able to know how to respond or what to do with that.
Oh.
And so it was really taking a toll on the instructors themselves.
Yeah.
So we had to make sure that we were taking better care of the instructors so that then they in turn could take better care of the students.
Oh, yeah.
So Nancy, do you see that in delivery or in the process of trauma-informed care, people's mindsets have changed in asking questions, in looking at broader scopes of the environment around them?
I think it's about how do you make sense out of things. It's about conceptualizing. How do you understand? You can look, for example, a child in a classroom, a small child in a classroom who is not focused, who is not on task.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can look at that child as being noncompliant, or being a bad child. You can take it personally, even if you're the teacher, right? Why doesn't this student care about what I want him or her to do? And you can also look at it as, what happened? Why is the student distracted? Did something happen that's getting in the way of this student being able to do their work?
Yeah.
And your approach as a teacher is going to be very different.
Sure.
If you are concerned that something might have happened to interfere with the student's learning, as opposed to if you assume that the student is just being
bad,
quote unquote, bad.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you think the student's being bad, then you're going to set a limit. You're going to tell them to get on task. It's going to be somewhat of a reprimand. Whereas if you're concerned that something might have happened, you're going to be that much more gentle and tender and understanding. And there's not going to be the reprimand nor the shame.
Right.
That student is disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of this is all about awareness, it sounds like.
There's a huge role of awareness.
Yeah, just being aware of that.
How do you understand things?
Yeah.
And being willing to ask the questions, so and not jumping to conclusions.
Yeah. And that part's got to be tough as far as asking questions, because, you know, then it might be someone you don't know that well, and how do you, you know, deeply personal kinds of things. So there's that. And this is a very broad question, but how do you go about asking someone if you suspect that maybe there's some kind of traumatic event?
Let me be very, very clear. I don't suggest that anybody go around asking people if they have a trauma history.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
That in and of itself could be re-traumatizing. Yeah.
Don't try this at home, kids.
There's no license
for
being intrusive. Right,
right, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Instead,
so how do you approach that? Yeah.
Instead, I think it's important to use some compassion and some kindness. You know, we're all moving so fast, and we have all been pushed to think about ourselves first in many contexts. And so, you know, if somebody does something while you're driving to you know, make you mad or whatever, we could just think that person's a jerk.
Right.
That person has, you know, no interpersonal skills, whatever.
Yes.
But what if that person is trying to rush to the hospital because somebody just ended up in the ER?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's a whole different understanding. So just using some compassion to not jump to the conclusion that people are mean or jerks or whatever, but to understand that there's a lot we don't know.
Oh, yeah. There's always a story behind it. Yeah.
No matter, you may have to go back a little ways to get the story. It might not be fresh today, but there's always a story. And so to assume that people are doing the best they can.
Yeah.
And not to think that people are just being bad or inconsiderate.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's super important.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It brings a total level of awareness that is beyond yourself, that it's not about being offended by somebody else's response to you, but taking a step back and understanding, is there something going on that I need to know about? And I'm telling you this because, you know, at different levels of access of services, it just gets very important to remember it's just not about the one who's interviewing.
Regardless of where you're at, I don't care if you're at the gas station.
Absolutely.
You know, the bottom line is if somebody is overreacting, in your opinion, somebody's reacting in a way that you don't expect, you can take that personally and think that this is about you. You know, why are they giving me such a hard time? Or you can step back and say, this has nothing to do with me.
Right.
Something has happened and this person is struggling.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right. That's a whole different understanding of why somebody might be reacting as they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, again, it's about compassion versus assumptions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's learning that it's not all about you, which I think is a message a lot of people haven't learned yet.
We take things personally way too often.
We sure do. We sure do. So we'll be back. All right, we're back. 97.1 FM Talk. This is the Medical Beat, formerly known as Ion Health. And we're here today with Nancy Spargo, CEO of Sparlin Mental Health. And we were talking about some stuff off the air. So Sony, what was that question we were asking Nancy?
We were asking Nancy as to how is trauma-informed care learned and implemented by organizations? Is this like something that you just do one time? Is this an ongoing process? And Nancy, help us out with that.
Yeah.
Again, another great question. Again, there are two in one here. To learn about trauma is one thing.
Sure.
And in order to be trauma-informed, you have to understand trauma. You need to know the impact of trauma. You need to know how trauma manifests in our lives on a daily basis, in our relationships, in our worldviews. Everything about us is reflected in that traumatic experience that impacts upon who we are, how we are, and our views. So we have to know trauma.
Yeah.
In order to become trauma-informed.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's not in and of itself trauma-informed. To know trauma, I say to speak trauma. I'm a language person, and so I talk about speaking trauma and the fluency that we might have in speaking trauma. Like, how much do you know about trauma and the impact of trauma? And so it's our duty to understand that, to know the impact of trauma and to know that well. In order to become trauma-informed, then, we have to take our knowledge of trauma and be able to apply those four R's and five principles that I referred to before. And quite honestly, that's where I think people get overwhelmed, stuck, confused. This is a big process. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. You're talking about a cultural transformation of an organization. And so it can take anywhere from 2 to 5 years to become trauma-informed as an organization. Having trauma training is important. That does not make you trauma-informed.
It's not like, hey, I saw the PowerPoints. Well, we're good now.
Yeah, more that's, than that. You may know something about trauma, but as somebody who also is an educator, I'm adjunct faculty at WashU, learning does not happen from viewing a PowerPoint.
Right. Very little,
it's about it's about the application. It's about the implementation. And I think that's where people get hung up. How do I know that I'm doing something in a trauma-informed way?
Does that actually will that mean the transformation of a person as well and not only the organization?
It's a transformation of how you understand things. It's a transformation of how you approach things.
Yeah.
Right? And it's about being very intentional in your efforts to avoid re-traumatization.
Yeah.
Very, very intentional.
So is the education done? And so I understand the education cannot be done just as a one-time event. As you said, it should be a process and sometimes takes many, many years of ongoing building of skills upon itself and continuing to practice it in the organization.
Right. So, I mean, it includes the policies and procedures. It includes staff benefits and compensation packages. It involves the board of directors for a nonprofit organization. This is all-inclusive, right? It's hard work, and at the same time, the results of that hard work are transformational, both in terms of the participants' experience as well as the employees' experience.
Yeah.
So it's a very serious commitment to become trauma-informed, and it's not something that you can do quickly.
Right.
It's just not going to work that way.
Now, do you have any programs for individuals? Do you have any programs? I do know that you are able to connect with organizations. But as an individual, if you wanted to start being trauma-informed, how can people access that approach, that education?
Quite honestly, there are a lot of resources now for becoming trauma-informed. There are multiple models of how to become trauma-informed. At Sparland, we have our own model, and it is a very comprehensive model and includes a preparation period that many other models do not include. We have the Missouri model, which was developed by the Trauma Roundtable of Missouri back in 2012. We started meeting as the Trauma Roundtable. We have Sandra Bloom and Brian Farragher's model, the Sanctuary model, which again is very good for an organizational approach. And we even have what they call TIP 57 from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, that is available online for download or ordering.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about the model you guys are using in your training and more about what Sparland Mental Health does?
So Sparland Mental Health, we have a training institute and we offer trainings to the community at large, to other professionals, other providers of all kinds. And so we always announce those through our listserv and through our website when we're offering trainings. And then we also contract with other agencies who are interested in becoming trauma-informed and want that coaching, want that guidance, or want the actual skill development around trauma specifically. Yeah. So that's some of the work that we do at Sparland Mental Health.
Any specific length of time for the courses that you have?
No, I have a Leadership Academy for Trauma-Informed Care that started out, to be very honest, as 5 half days and multiple learning labs. I actually took that and turned it into a course, a 3-hour course at the Brown School. And I have whittled it down to a 1-day training for those who just need a brief introduction.
Sure.
So I have all different versions of that training, but it's about, it's for the leaders, the organizational leaders, so that they know what to expect and how it works.
Yes.
So that's a good place to start. Would that be, would you consider
if,
that
if
a good
you
place?
Are if you're in a leadership role, for yeah, sure. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And do you do any presentations in the community on introducing trauma-informed care to different places?
Too many to count.
Is that right?
Right.
Yeah, we all
too many
need
to
it,
count.
Don't we? You know, I
well,
think,
there's.
You know.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there as to what trauma-informed care is and how to do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a new field.
Absolutely.
It started in 1994. And so, and that was through, again, SAMHSA that organized the first conference. So before 1994, there wasn't a field of trauma-informed care.
Yeah.
We have become sensitive and more tolerant as hopefully as a community because of understanding that there is trauma out there. But now our next step is how do we access and how do we improve our skills with trauma?
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think it's important. One of the things that Sparlin also works on is access to care and the quality of the services that are available. So it's not.
All right. We're back. 97.1 FM Talk. This is the Medical Beat, formerly known as Ion Health. And we're here today with Nancy Spargo, CEO of Sparlin Mental Health. And we were talking about some stuff off the air. So Sony, what was that question we were asking Nancy?
We were asking Nancy as to how is trauma-informed care learned and implemented by organizations? Is this like something that you just do one time? Is this an ongoing process? And Nancy, help us out with that.
Yeah.
Again, another great question. Again, there are two in one here. To learn about trauma is one thing.
Sure.
And in order to be trauma-informed, you have to understand trauma. Yeah. You need to know the impact of trauma. You need to know how trauma manifests in our lives on a daily basis, in our relationships, in our worldviews. Everything about us is reflected in that traumatic experience that impacts upon who we are, how we are, and our views. So we have to know trauma.
Yeah.
In order to become trauma-informed.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's not in and of itself trauma-informed. To know trauma, I say to speak trauma. I'm a language person, and so I talk about speaking trauma and the fluency that we might have in speaking trauma. Like, how much do you know about trauma and the impact of trauma? And so it's our duty to understand that, to know the impact of trauma and to know that well. In order to become trauma-informed, then, we have to take our knowledge of trauma and be able to apply those 4 R's and 5 principles that I referred to before. And quite honestly, that's where I think people get overwhelmed, stuck, confused. This is a big process. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. You're talking about a cultural transformation of an
Absolutely.
Organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it can take anywhere from 2 to 5 years to become trauma-informed as an organization. Having trauma training is important. That does not make you trauma-informed.
It's not like, hey, I saw the PowerPoints, well, we're good now.
You may know something about trauma, but as somebody who also is an educator, I'm adjunct faculty at WashU, learning does not happen from viewing a PowerPoint.
Right. Very
right?
little,
it's about the It's about the application. It's about the implementation. And I think that's where people get hung up. How do I know that I'm doing something in a trauma-informed way?
Does that actually mean... Will that mean the transformation of a person as well and not only the organization?
It's a transformation of how you understand things. It's a transformation of how you approach things.
Yeah.
Right? And it's about being very intentional in your efforts to avoid re-traumatization.
Yeah.
Very intentional.
So is the education done? And so I understand the education cannot be done just as a one-time event. as you said, it should be a process and sometimes takes many, many years of ongoing building of skills upon itself and continuing to practice it mm-hmm. in the organization.
Right. So, I mean, it includes the policies and procedures. It includes staff benefits and compensation packages. It involves the board of directors for a nonprofit organization. This is all inclusive, right? It's hard work. And at the same time, the results of that hard work are transformational, both in terms of the participants' experience as well as the employees' experience.
Yeah.
So it's a very serious commitment to become trauma-informed, and it's not something that you can do quickly.
Right.
It's just not going to work that way.
Now, do you have any programs for individuals? Do you have any programs? I do know that you are able to connect with organizations, but as an individual, if you wanted to start being trauma-informed, how can people access that approach, that education?
Quite honestly, there are a lot of resources now for becoming trauma-informed. There are multiple models mm-hmm. of how to become trauma-informed. At Sparlin, we have our own model, and it is a very comprehensive model and includes a preparation period that many other models do not include. We have the Missouri model, which was developed by the Trauma Roundtable of Missouri back in 2012. We started meeting as the Trauma Roundtable. We have Sandra Bloom and Brian Farragher's model, the Sanctuary model, which again is very good for an organizational approach. And we even have what they call TIP 57 from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, that is available online for download or ordering.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about the model you guys are using in your training and more about what Sparlin Mental Health does?
So Sparlin Mental Health, we have a training institute, and we offer trainings to the community at large, to other professionals, other providers of all kinds. And so we always announce those through our listserv and through our website when we're offering trainings. And then we also contract with other agencies who are interested in becoming trauma-informed and want that coaching, want that guidance, or want the actual skill development around trauma specifically. Yeah. So that's some of the work that we do at Sparlin Mental Health.
Any specific length of time for the courses that you have?
No, I have a Leadership Academy for Trauma-Informed Care that started out, to be very honest, as 5 half-days and multiple learning labs. I actually took that and turned it into a course, a 3-hour course at the Brown School. And I have whittled it down to a 1-day training for those who just need a brief introduction. So I have all different versions of that training, but it's for the leaders, the organizational leaders, so that they know what to expect and how it works.
Yes.
So that's a good place to start. Would you consider
If you're in a leadership role, for sure. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And do you do any presentations in the community on introducing trauma-informed care to different places?
Too many to count.
Is that right? I
think there's a lot of misinformation out there as to what trauma-informed care is and how to do it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a new field.
Absolutely.
It started in 1994. And that was through, again, SAMHSA that organized the first conference. So before 1994, there wasn't a field of trauma-informed care.
Have become sensitive and more tolerant, as hopefully as a community, because of understanding that there is trauma out there. But now our next step is, how do we access and how do we improve our skills with trauma?
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think it's important. One of the things that Sparlin also works on is access to care and the quality of the services that are available. So it's not easy finding services, depending upon your resources, your location, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's not always easy to find the specific resources you need to be able to treat trauma or to learn how to become trauma-informed.
Right, yeah.
Both and.
Yeah.
And if there are people out there who are interested in their organization becoming educated in trauma-informed care, how would they find you guys? What's the best place? What's the easiest way to find you guys? On Google.
Well, there's a telephone number.
Okay. Let's go with the website.
And there's a website.
Yeah. And it's sparlinmentalhealth.com. Didn't have my reading glasses with me, so I couldn't read that card.
It's sparlinmentalhealth.com.
Sparlinmentalhealth.com. Okay. Well, great discussion. Thank you very much.
Yeah. That was wonderful.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And we're going to be back. Nancy will still be here with us. We're going to talk about the coronavirus. What else?
And now for a moment of science.
Science.
All right. We're going to have a moment of science, people.
We want true science, Steve.
True science.
Yes.
I believe.
Not alt science.
That's right. True science. 97.1. This is the Medical Beat. And this is our feature, A Moment of Science. We're going to be talking today about the coronavirus outbreak. Have you guys heard about that?
No. What is that? Please tell us a little bit.
It's a thing. It's a thing that's happening. And so boy, we could spend several whole shows on that, but we have, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes. So, hey, we're going to condense it. But so it's a whole lot has changed just in the last couple of days. We have the NHL, the NBA, the XFL all canceling schools, parades, declarations of emergency in states and in the country. Just in the last couple of days, we started taking it, taking things very, very seriously.
Even clinics are being changed.
Right. So a whole lot has been happening just recently. And so there's a whole lot we can say about this. And I think probably the best place to start is one thing that you hear a lot. You've probably heard a lot of people say something like, why are we making such a big deal out of this when the flu kills so many more people than coronavirus? And that's a legitimate point and a legitimate half-truth. I mean, the part that's true is that the flu kills something like 35 to 40,000 people per year in the United States, and coronavirus has killed, you know, still just in the double digits, a much, much smaller number. So those parts
are
true.
Why are we making such a big focus on this? So help us, Steve.
Yes.
Let us understand this.
Well, I'll just do that. Well, thank you for asking, Sony. So here's the deal. One thing is that if someone catches COVID, the coronavirus that causes this particular illness, which we'll refer to as COVID. If someone catches that, the chances of death are something like 10 to 20 times greater than that of the flu. So if you get it, it's quite a bit more dangerous, especially if you're in certain demographics. The other thing, the other important point is that the spreadability, that's a word I just now made up, but the spreadability of COVID is much greater than the spreadability of the flu. So now that it's here, now that we've got it, it is spreading.
Very fast.
It is spreading quickly. And this is not conjecture. It's direct observation that this has been spreading in other parts of the world. And there's nothing, we're not supermen in America. Right. It's going to happen to us like it is.
It has traveled beyond the borders of countries. And so it is time to take it seriously.
Absolutely. Right. Yes. Yeah. And I think the other concern here is that with that fast spreading and with a lot of people who get the illness needing, you know, even the people who get very ill but are going to survive, they might need intensive care unit, they might need a ventilator. We very well could get in a situation where the number of very, very, very sick people greatly exceeds the capacity of the hospitals,
right.
So we could end up like we have in Italy now, where we have sort of a hellscape of hospitals with, you know, beds in the hallways, beds in the lobbies, gymnasiums packed with cots with sick people in it, and physicians having to decide who lives and who dies because there's not enough ventilators to go around.
Right.
So that's the other concern about this. So we have good news and bad news that this happened recently to help us get all this in context. One of the pieces of good news is that things are looking a lot better, or I should say a lot less bad in China. China's where all this began. Most of the cases are still in China. But the good news is they have been able to start getting this under control. The number of new cases in China is now very small each day, a very small number of new cases every day. So there's a lot more people recovering than there are getting it in China. So
that's definitely good news.
That's definitely good news. And it proves that we can defeat the virus if we make enough points. And another piece of good news is that in South Korea, they had a horrible outbreak there, but they're getting that. It's bad, but they're getting it under control. And also, I think in the United States, we've finally snapped out of our slumber and we're starting to do stuff here too. And that, whether it's too late or not, it remains to be seen, but that's going to be a huge help. So now for the bad news.
We're reducing spreadability, Steve.
We are reducing spreadability.
Yes.
I'm standing several feet away from Sony, and I'm standing even further away from Nancy here.
And so, definitely further away from Carl.
Yeah, way far away from Carl. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So we're doing that social distancing thing. So on the bad news side, things are really bad in China, really bad in Iran, a lot of very scary stories.
I think really bad in Italy.
Really bad in Italy. Did I say Italy?
You said China, but
oh my gosh, did I say China? I meant Italy. Sorry. I mean, it is bad in China too. But yeah. Sorry, I meant to say Italy. So things are really bad in Italy. Really bad in Iran. And the other piece of bad news is in the USA, we're way behind in testing people for the coronavirus. Other countries like South Korea tests more people each day than we have total in the entire outbreak. So what we know is how many confirmed cases we have, but we're doing a really, really bad job of testing. If someone is sick and needs a coronavirus test, they're probably not going to get it.
Correct.
Probably not going to get, and so that's the bad news. That's we think that's going to get fixed, but we don't know when, don't know how.
Well, going to the hopeful news.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Here in St. Louis City and County,
yes,
we're now starting to have drive-through testing set up,
yes,
conceptualized,
like they do in South Korea. Yes.
Yes, and so we're moving towards that process, and hopefully we'll start understanding who needs it.
Right.
Just don't drive up to those drive-through testing. Make your appointments as you're instructed.
Yeah, they have some kind of procedure. You have to call ahead.
You've got to call
ahead.
And there is a procedure in place.
Yeah.
But we are moving. We are actually going down this process and doing the setups and trying to put this under control. And again, we have canceled so many big events here in the city and county and surrounding counties to be able to reduce that harm and threat of exposure.
Which is exactly what we needed to do.
Absolutely.
And his history has proven that makes a really big difference. I think not to delve too far into it, but the Spanish flu in 1918, St. Louis clamped down.
Yes.
Philadelphia did not. Philadelphia had bodies piling up and St. Louis did relatively well. So today we have to do the right thing. And if you wait till things are really, really bad, then that's too late. Cows out of the barn. Cows
be kind
out of the
barn. To people. Yeah. Everybody's in the same boat, but with social distancing. Let's be kind to each other.
Be kind to each other at a distance. Be kind, but don't touch. So best case scenario is that we look back all this and say, hey, we overreacted. It's not that bad. That's the best case scenario. That's the best way that this could turn out. Worst case scenario is we end up like a gigantic version of Italy with a huge death toll and economic hardship all around. It's going to be somewhere in between. Hopefully it'll be more toward the best case scenario. And I'm feeling a lot better about this now because people are acting and doing the right thing. So what can we do? We can test people, social distancing, wash your hands, darn it.
Wash your hands.
Don't panic and stop spreading around misinformation. You know, that meme you posted on Facebook? It's baloney. I read it. It's not true. Stop posting that crud on Facebook.
Wash your hands. So socially distance yourself.
Yeah. So thank you. And thank you for being here, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy. You're very welcome.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, yes. Sparling mental health. All right. So we talked about all the stuff, and Carl is signaling me. Out we go. Ciao.
Get more at 971talk.com.
And now for a moment of science.
All right. We're going to have a moment of science, people.
We want true science, Steve.
True science.
Yes.
I believe.
Not alt science.
That's right. True science. 97.1. This is the Medical Beat. And this is our feature, A Moment of Science. We're going to be talking today about the coronavirus outbreak. Have you guys heard about that?
No. What is that? Please tell us a little bit.
It's a thing. It's a thing that's happening. And so boy, we could spend several whole shows on that, but we have, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes. So, hey, we're going to condense it. But so it's a whole lot has changed just in the last couple of days. We have the NHL, the NBA, the XFL all canceling schools, parades, declarations of emergency in states and in the country. Just in the last couple of days, we started taking it taking things very, very seriously.
Even clinics are being changed.
Right. So a whole lot has been happening just recently. And so there's a whole lot we can say about this. And I think probably the best place to start is one thing that you hear a lot. You've probably heard a lot of people say something like, why are we making such a big deal out of this when the flu kills so many more people than coronavirus? And that's a legitimate point and a legitimate half-truth. I mean, the part that's true is that the flu kills something like 35 to 40,000 people per year in the United States, and coronavirus has killed, you know, still just in the double digits, a much, much smaller number. So those parts
are
true.
Why are we making such a big focus on this? So help us, Steve.
Yes.
Let us understand this.
Well, I'll just do that. Well, thank you for asking, Sony. So here's the deal. One thing is that if someone catches COVID, the coronavirus that causes this particular illness, which we'll refer to as COVID, if someone catches that, the chances of death are something like 10 to 20 times greater than that of the flu. So if you get it, it's quite a bit more dangerous, especially if you're in certain demographics. The other thing, the other important point, is that the spreadability, that's a word I just now made up, but the spreadability of COVID is much greater than the spreadability of the flu. So now that it's here, now that we've got it, it is spreading.
Very fast.
It is spreading quickly. And this is not conjecture, it's direct observation that this has been spreading in other parts of the world. And there's nothing, we're not supermen in America. Right. It's going to happen to us like it is.
It has traveled beyond the borders of countries, and so it is time to take it seriously.
Absolutely. Right. Yes. Yeah. And I think the other concern here is that with that fast spreading and with a lot of people who get the illness needing, you know, even the people who get very ill but are going to survive, they might need intensive care unit, they might need a ventilator, we very well could get in a situation where the number of very, very, very sick people greatly exceeds the capacity of the hospitals,
right.
So we could end up like we have in Italy now, where we have sort of a hellscape of hospitals with, you know, beds in the hallways, beds in the lobbies, gymnasiums packed with cots with sick people in it, and physicians having to decide who lives and who dies because there's not enough ventilators to go around. Right. So that's the other concern about this. So we have good news and bad news that this happened recently to help us get all this in context. One of the pieces of good news is that things are looking a lot better, or I should say a lot less bad in China. China's where all this began. Most of the cases are still in China. But the good news is they have been able to start getting this under control. The number of new cases in China is now very small each day, a very small number of new cases every day. So there's a lot more people recovering than there are getting it in China. So
that's definitely good news.
That's definitely good news. And it proves that we can defeat the virus if we make enough points. And another piece of good news is that in South Korea, they had a horrible outbreak there, but they're getting that. It's bad, but they're getting it under control. And also, I think in the United States, we've finally snapped out of our slumber and we're starting to do stuff here too. And that, whether it's too late or not, it remains to be seen, but that's going to be a huge help. So now for the bad news.
We're reducing spreadability, Steve.
We are reducing spreadability.
Yes.
I'm standing several feet away from Sony, and I'm standing even further away from Nancy here.
And so, definitely further away from Carl.
Yeah, way far away from Carl. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So we're doing that social distancing thing. So on the bad news side, things are really bad in China, really bad in Iran, a lot of very scary stories.
I think really bad in Italy.
Really bad in Italy. Did I say Italy?
You said China, but
oh my gosh, did I say China? I meant Italy. Sorry. I mean, it is bad in China too. But yeah. Sorry, I meant to say Italy. So things are really bad in Italy. Really bad in Iran. And the other piece of bad news is in the USA, we're way behind in testing people for the coronavirus. Other countries like South Korea tests more people each day than we have total in the entire outbreak. So what we know is how many confirmed cases we have, but we're doing a really, really bad job of testing. If someone is sick and needs a coronavirus test, they're probably not going to get it.
Correct.
Probably not going to get, and so that's the bad news. That's we think that's going to get fixed, but we don't know when, don't know how.
Well, going to the hopeful news.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Here in St. Louis City and County,
yes.
We're now starting to have drive-through testing set up,
yes.
Conceptualized.
Like they do in South Korea. Yes.
Yes. And so we're moving towards that process, and hopefully we'll start understanding who needs it.
Right.
Just don't drive up to those drive-through testing. Make your appointments as you're instructed.
Yeah, they have some kind of procedure. You have to call ahead.
You've got to call
ahead.
And there is a procedure in place.
Yeah.
But we are moving. We are actually going down this process and doing the setups and trying to put this under control. And again, we have canceled so many big events here in the city and county and surrounding counties to be able to reduce that harm and threat of exposure.
Which is exactly what we needed to do.
Absolutely.
And his history has proven that makes a really big difference. I think not to delve too far into it, but the Spanish flu in 1918, St. Louis clamped down.
Yes.
Philadelphia did not. Philadelphia had bodies piling up and St. Louis did relatively well. So today we have to do the right thing. And if you wait till things are really, really bad, then that's too late. Cows out of the barn. Cows
be kind
out of
to people. Yeah. Everybody's in the same boat, but with social distancing. Let's be kind to each other.
Be kind to each other at a distance. Be kind, but don't touch. So best case scenario is that we look back all this and say, hey, we overreacted. It's not that bad. That's the best case scenario. That's the best way that this could turn out. Worst case scenario is we end up like a gigantic version of Italy with a huge death toll and economic hardship all around. It's going to be somewhere in between. Hopefully it'll be more toward the best case scenario. And I'm feeling a lot better about this now because people are acting and doing the right thing. So what can we do? We can test people, social distancing, wash your hands, darn it.
Wash your hands.
Don't panic and stop spreading around misinformation. You know, that meme you posted on Facebook, it's baloney. I read it. It's not true. Stop posting that crud on Facebook.
Wash your hands. So socially distance yourself.
Yeah. So thank you. And thank you for being here, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy.
You're very welcome.
That was wonderful.
Yeah. Yes. Sparland Mental Health. All right. So we talked about all the stuff, and Carl is signaling me. Out we go. Ciao.
Get more at 971talk.com.